Okay, so let's start. Before we start, I just wanted to I just want to talk about a little thing at the end of Tuesday, which is the error function for k-means clustering, which is where I drew it wrong on the board. And then I was thinking about it, it's actually worth, it's sort of, I think, quite, what's the word I want to say? Informative to see what the two different things were. So we have the basic error the basic error function is this sum square thing. And I kind of had the thing on the board so that we're looking at the error of xi minus the mean of cluster 0 squared summed over those things in I. You've got an indicator variable there as well, so that would be zi0 plus the sum over I of the next cluster, xi minus m1 all squared times the indicator variable of zi1. So that's the sum of the squared differences for the two clusters. And there's this issue with normalization. So there's sort of three things that you could do. One actually is if you just don't normalize it at all, then that's okay. That gives you the total sum squared error. Then the next thing you could do, which is the thing in the notes and is an equally okay thing to do, is to normalize by 1 over n, and that's basically gives you like the sum squared error per point, and that's a fine thing to do. The other thing that we did, I'm looking for an eraser. The other thing that we did was to normalize by the number of points in each cluster. So call it 1 over, I'll call that 1 over C0 and 1 over C1 there, where you have C0 points in cluster 0 and C1 points in cluster 1. And for sure, that gives you, if you go and take the local terms, it gives you the average error per point per cluster. But if you sum those up for all the clusters, it doesn't take into account the number of points in each cluster when you get the total thing. So imagine you had a setup where you had one cluster with 1 million points and two other clusters each with 5 points. When you come to do the overall sum, if you did it with this sort of normalization, the clusters with 5 points have exactly the same weighting as the clusters with 1 million points. And that's probably not what you want because you want to put extra weighting on the clusters with the most points. So that's the kind of reason that we do this 1 over n normalization. The meta rule is if there's a mistake that looks plausible, find out what it means, because it might possibly be interesting or might give you some insight. So that was, whoa, I didn't quite mean to do that. Okay, so that was just a comment on clustering, following on from Tuesday. So today, as you'll have seen, it's me and not KK, and we're going to talk about classification and stuff. So this is starting to set the scene for a few lectures, really. In a sense, what I want to talk about today is classification as a kind of general type of thing. And then we'll spend a short amount of time looking at k-nearest neighbor classification. This is I was going to say this is deceptively simple, but it's not. It's simple, really, in some sense. Although the analysis of it, which we're not going to do in this course, can get quite rich, and it's one of these things that falls in the class of a method that's simple to describe. You can describe it to anybody. You don't need any sort of mathematical knowledge to understand how it works, but it turns out to be quite a rich method, and we're not going to have time to go into it in the detail it can deserve. But let me tell you about it anyway. So classification. This is the setup that we're looking at. So in classification, it's different to clustering. So in clustering is what you can call an unsupervised task, in that you have data vectors, but you don't have any labels associated with those data vectors. So they're things you record from the world, but you haven't got a label associated with them. In classification, we're looking at things where we go and have a data vector, we have a feature vector, call it X, but we also have a label for that feature vector, C. Those labels often have to be acquired, perhaps through some kind of manual intervention, at least initially. So for example, if you were doing handwriting recognition and your data vectors were feature vectors corresponding to people kind of writing digits or something like that, then the label is the actual label that corresponds to that digit. So you go and have an image of somebody having written zero, and then the label is the label zero. And typically you would need, at least to start things off, you would need a person to go and tell you what those labels are. And that's how a lot of pattern recognition works. So we have a training set which has N of these feature vectors, big N of these feature vectors, and their labels. And the aim is that we're going to use some kind of algorithm which is going to train a classifier. So by training a classifier, we mean setting its parameters. So all the models we look at here have parameters, and K means clustering the parameters with the centers. In K nearest neighbor, we're going to find that the parameters are, in fact, exceptionally simple to train. So we use a learning algorithm to train the classifier, so set its parameters, using this training set of N feature vectors and their labels. And then if you want to find out how well your setup works, it's doing that flashing thing again, isn't it? Is that stopping it? Yeah, okay. If you want to find out how well your system works, you don't actually want to. What you're concerned about is not the training set error. Because intuitively speaking, you can get a system and you can really optimize for how well things work on the training set. But your training set is only a small sample of the possible data in that problem space. So if you've got a training set of, 100,000 examples of handwritten digits, well, that's really great, and you can, with that data, you can go a long way and you can start training classifiers, but it's still only a sample of the possible space of handwritten digits out there. There are standard training sets of 100,000 digits out there, but I didn't write any of those digits and you didn't write any of those digits. So what we're concerned with is how well our classifier works on new data. And this is the big problem in machine learning. What you want to do is you don't want to optimize performance in the training set directly. You want to use the training set to optimize performance on new data. And of course, by definition, you don't have that data. But once you've done it, you can test things by using a test set. And a test set is a set of feature vectors for which your classifier must assign labels. And you can see how well your classifier works at classifying things in the training set, but we're much more interested in seeing how well it classifies things on the test set. And so when we're doing this, we want to see, whenever we're saying how well, we want to have some kind of function. And typically, we will use some kind of error function. So in the case of k-means clustering, we had the error function that we were just talking about, which was this sort of squared deviation error function. If you're looking at a classifier, one possibility is simply to count the number of misclassifications. So your error function is just how many classification errors your system makes, which you might count as a percentage. That's something that you want to optimize. Okay, so let's look at a very simple example, just to sort of get you in the feel for what classification might consist of. So this is an easy example, and the example we have is that we'd like to classify apples and pears. And we're going to, the information we have about our apples and pears is that we just have the circumference and the height. And the height is the sort of highest dimension, so there's no sort of sideways issues here. So we have the circumference and the height, and the idea is that these, so it's a two-element feature vector, and you might believe you can classify things quite well because apples sort of tend to be round, so the sort of circumference height ratio is in one part of the space, whereas for a given circumference, pears tend to have a higher height because they have that well-known pear shape. We can plot some data. I have a feeling, I did this a couple of years ago, but if I remember correctly, I have a feeling this is real data. I think I measured some apples and pears, because you can't beat real data. Seriously, you can't beat real data. So I think this is real data. And the red triangles obviously correspond to pears because they're higher, and the blue circles correspond to apples. And of course, what we want to do is to there's no of course about it, but what we want to do is to find a classifier. So if we have a new piece of data where we're just given height and circumference, we'd like to be able to classify it as reliably as possible into either class apples or class pears. So one way of thinking about this problem is that you... Sometimes your own slides can surprise you. So we might have a piece of new data coming up here, and there I think you'll be pretty clear that you wanted to classify it as a pear. It's right up in pear land. And you might have another data point coming here, and you'd be pretty clear you'd want to classify it as an apple. And then you might have a data point like this. And it's certainly not obvious how you should classify that. It could be it's sort of on the boundary region between pears and apples. And this is an important point because for sure that data is recorded from something that is an apple and a pear, but you may get the same or almost identical data coming from a pear or coming from an apple. So in this particular feature space, there is this sort of confusable area where you don't know if the data is a pear or an apple. In real life, you get a lot more data than just the height and the circumference. You get color information, you get texture information, you know, just even the texture of the skin. Pears have slightly rougher skins typically than apples. You get smell information if you're actually holding it. Maybe you get weight information. Are pears heavier than apples? I think they might be because they tend to be a bit juicier. You get all this other information. You get the length of the stalk. So pears have this kind of very, very distinctive type of stalk at the top that apples don't have. There's all this other information that you're able to integrate. You're not just working with the feature vectors of circumference and height. And that's an important point to bear in mind because very often when we're doing these pattern recognition tasks, you have quite limited data. You only have the data that, in this case, that your sensors picked up. So presumably, this is from some kind of mythical place where you didn't have camera information, and you certainly didn't have olfactory sensors or anything like that. You just had some kind of machine where it just kind of measured up and gave you these two numbers. But that's the data that you have to work on, and that data is pretty good at characterizing apples from pears, but it can still there will still be some that are quite confusable. So one of the things you might want to do is to try and find an optimal dividing line between the class of apples and pears, and you might want to go and look at get a straight line to go in the right place. And there's no one single right place where you can put the there's no single right decision boundary to have. So it may be that from the data that you've seen, this dotted line here is the one which seems to be best in terms of, you know, your best guess of minimizing errors of future apples and future pears. However, you don't always care, you know, you might not always care precisely about minimizing errors. For example, you might have a situation where what the task is to select pears, and you want to make sure you only select pears. In that case, you might be better to have a decision boundary up where the red line is. And that means if you've got a decision boundary up there, then you seem to have a reasonably good probability of selecting pears if it's above the red line. And the cost is there'll be some pears that you don't select as pears, you assume as apples. But you'll have a reasonably pure selection of pears. And likewise, if you wanted to do the same for apples, you might go and choose the blue line at the bottom. So the point here is that there are different possible decision boundaries. And there's it can depend on the context as to how you place that decision boundary. We're going to come back to decision boundaries later in the course, but the approach we're going to look at for classifying new things as apples or pears here is even simpler than just looking at decision boundaries. So what we're going to look at is a very simple approach called nearest neighbor classification. And nearest neighbor classification, you basically label a test example to have the label of the closest training example. So label it as an error there, sorry. Label a test example to have the label of the closest training example. Variant on it, slightly more robust, is a thing called k-nearest neighbor classification, which is where you find the k-nearest points in the training set to the test example, and you basically take a majority vote of those k-class labels, and the class that gets the most votes wins. This is all dead simple. And like I said, training a k-nearest classifier is really simple. You just have to store the training set. So in fact, the classifier itself is the training set. So it's, in a sense, this is a very powerful approach because you're making use of all the training data. The problem is that at test time it can be quite computationally demanding, because if you've got a very large set of training data and it might be in quite high dimensions, then it can be quite expensive to be able to find the k closest examples. Potentially, you might need to compute the distance, and typically we'd be using a Euclidean distance. You might need to compute the distance between the test example and every single training example. In the apples and pears examples, we had what, 40 training examples. That's not too bad. Imagine you're doing the digit recognition with, you know, we've got a million examples of digits. Then that becomes quite a big computation that you potentially have to do for each test point. There are more efficient ways to do this, and there are data structures that I don't think we'll talk about, but are very interesting. For example, a data structure called the KD tree, which can make, in the average case, finding nearest neighbors much more efficient, although you can always find worst case sets of data, which means that you virtually have to go and compute distances to every point. But this is a particular data structure that can make things more efficient. So the thing about nearest neighbor classification then is that training is very easy. You just store the training set, and then testing, you just basically get your test point, position it in the training set, and find those points that are closest to it, and assign it to the class of the majority of points of the class of the majority of points that are in the k closest to it. So it's a very simple approach, and its power, as I say, its power is that you're using the training data raw. So you really are taking advantage of all the training data. There are various weaknesses to this method. There's clearly a computational weakness, and also it's a fact that the method isn't basically building any kind of abstract model. It's just using the data directly, and that's both a strength and a weakness. So if we look at how we classify this, the test data with k nearest neighbor, then this guy clearly, no matter sort of what k you take, is going to be classified as the pairs, the red triangles. And this test data point, no matter sort of what k you take, you know, the nearest 1, 2, 3, 4 many points are all apples. So those will be classified unambiguously. However, if we look at the ambiguous one in the middle, then actually in this case it can be very dependent on the value of k. So if you took one nearest neighbor, it would be classified as a pair. And if we took two nearest neighbor, well, toss a coin. If you take three nearest neighbor, classify it as an apple. If you take five nearest neighbor, back to classifying it as a pear. If you take nine nearest neighbor, back to classifying it as an apple. So this is a good example where it really is quite ambiguous, and it can be quite dependent on the value of k. What you can think about, and it turns out you can analyze this, what you can think about is that as you take k larger, then you're obviously paying less attention to the sort of immediate, the very, very immediate locality of the test data point. You're basically kind of smoothing it more and more with data points that are around it. So the thing is that if k got really huge, then you'd just start to be classifying, you know, if k was really huge, like all the points, you'd just start classifying things according to the distribution of points in the data. So, you know, if there were 50 apples and 30 pears in the data, once k gets quite large, you're just always classifying things as apples simply because there's more apples and pears. So this is kind of like a huge smoothing. But if things are really small, then you can be quite vulnerable to the very particularities of the data. So that's one thing about k nearest neighbor. The other thing about k nearest neighbor, and it's almost worth not putting this on the slide actually. This is just if you really want to write down the k nearest neighbor algorithm in a kind of very rigorous way, this is one way you can do it. So it's basically saying that we compute the distance between our test point z and each training example, which are the x's, and we select the k nearest neighbors. So we select those k nearest training examples, and then we classify z simply by kind of doing a count, and we go and use this indicator function, which is 1 when the class of the training data point equals is c, and we go through all the classes and see which one has the most score. So this is just a kind of fancy way of writing a majority vote. So it's one of these cases. Sometimes you write things mathematically because the explanation of the algorithm can be quite wordy, and the mathematics can be beautifully clear and precise. I think this is actually one of the opposite cases, where the explanation of the algorithm is really quite clear. You can explain it. You can explain it very carefully, non-mathematically, and then you write it down mathematically, and it's just kind of annoying because you end up with kind of heavy notation just because you want to write about a majority vote and things. So it's worth being able to do this, but if it so happened there was an exam, which I guess it does so happen there's an exam, and it so happened there was a question on the exam about writing the k nearest neighbor algorithm. If you wrote it like that, beautiful, lovely, and if you get it right, perfect. But equally, if you write it down in clear, unambiguous English, then that's great too. And I think k nearest neighbor is one of those points where writing it in clear, unambiguous English is better than writing it mathematically. There will be many other things on this course where actually writing it in clear, unambiguous English, and I mean unambiguous, is not as good as just writing down an equation. But in this case, I think the equation is overly complicated in some sense for what we need to do. Yeah, let me just talk a little bit about the geometry of nearest neighbors. So one of the things, if we go, we go too many slides. I should have had a hyperlink back. If we go way back here. This was quite nice because what it shows you is it shows you the decision boundaries between the two classes between the two classes. And in particular, because it's done in two dimensions, it's something you can visualize quite nicely. And it's quite a nice thing to have. And it can help you analyze a problem if you can set up a problem in terms of the decision boundaries. So the question is, well, if you're doing k nearest neighbor, surely you can draw similar decision boundaries, not necessarily straight lines, on the map like this, and for sure you could do it. I mean, you could take a sampling approach where you just go and kind of have a very high resolution grid, and each point on the grid you do a k nearest neighbor calculation for that with whatever value of k you want, and you can class it as apple or pear, and then you can draw an entire map. That's a really slow way to do things, but it would give you a map. So the question is, can we actually get that map? Can we actually get the map of the decision boundaries? And what we want to know, so what these decision boundaries tell you is that if you took this dotted line of the decision boundary, then everything above it you would colour red, and everything below it you would colour blue. And the dotted line gives you the boundary between the red and the blue. What we would like to do is to draw the map for k nearest neighbour, and to keep it simple, we'll just look at one nearest neighbour. It gets a bit complicated over one. We'd like to draw the map for one nearest neighbour, and can we draw the map of what would be coloured red and what would be coloured blue, and hence can we get a decision boundary? So the decision boundary is just the line between the two classes. So for one nearest neighbour, we can do this, and it's a vaguely interesting thing to look at. In so much any of this is interesting to you at 4:45 on a Friday, but I don't know. You're here for a reason, right? So you must have made some kind of calculation. So we're looking. So I'm calling it the geometry of nearest neighbours. So this is if we kind of want to go and look at what's going at how the boundaries go. Well, what you can start to do is you can basically draw a tessellation. So you can go and find the regions of space where, in this region here, for example, this blue point will be the closest point to any test point you care to draw here, because we only, in this case, we've got this simple example with six points. So in this region here, these are all the points whose single nearest neighbour would be that blue point. Likewise, in this region here, these are all the points whose single nearest neighbour would be that red point. So this is basically just drawing a tessellation to show that. And the way we did this is we're just basically basically drawing the lines between all the points, and then drawing the bisectors of those lines. And anything above this is closer to that guy, and anything below it is closer to that guy, and so on. So what we've done is we've just separated our space into regions, and each region corresponds to the area where the points in that region are closest to the data point that we have. There's another question related to this on the tutorial this week, actually. So this is a kind of reasonably useful thing to do. Obviously, it gets complicated if you have lots and lots of points, but obviously it's a fairly algorithmic thing to do. There's a whole field called computational geometry which looks at this in much harder problems, and we have computers, so you can do this for more points if you so wish. Then the interesting thing about this is that given we've divided it up into regions, we can, and we'll take away the bisectors to make it clearer, so we've got these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 regions, and each of the six regions corresponds to a particular point, and then given that, we can in fact draw a decision boundary, because in this case, if for these particular points, if we take this as our boundary, then everything this side of the boundary has as nearest neighbour a red, and everything as this side of the boundary has as nearest neighbour a blue. So it's actually what one nearest neighbour is doing here is it's drawing us a more complex boundary than just drawing a single straight line. It's drawing what's called a piecewise linear boundary. So it's basically pieces of different straight lines that are kind of joined together to go and make this particular boundary. So this is just a simple way of analysing what goes on in this case, which is one nearest neighbour. Okay. So, for the last 15 minutes, I want to talk about something which is a little bit more general, but it's something, it's just worth having the concept in your head, because it's going to come up in some future lectures. And it's an issue of generative modeling, generative models. And it's a nice and a very important concept, and is very closely linked to building probabilistic models of data. So what we want to do is to model data, and we want to classify data. And there's a couple of, if you like, conceptual approaches to doing this. So as I said, what we want to do is we want to estimate a function so that it replicates the training data as well as possible, but also generalizes to new data. And the two ways we can do this are called, these are two sort of ends of the spectrum in a sense, although there's a nice relation between them, as we'll see later, are called generative modeling and discriminative modeling. So in a sense, discriminative modeling is kind of what we've been thinking about already, because the idea of discriminative modeling is we want to somehow design a function which finds the boundaries between the classes. So if, in a sense, if we go back to the kind of early slide, which I'm not going to bother kind of flicking back to, when we were drawing straight lines between the apples and the pears, then our discriminative function is that straight line function. In that case, it's a very simple function. It's just a linear function. And that function defines the decision boundary between the apples class and the pears class. So if you had a classifier, and you can have classifiers, and they're a very important class of classifier, which takes its decision boundaries as linear, then the learning problem is to go and find the parameters of that function. So, you know, if it's a kind of straight line, it has a slope and an intercept. More generally, if you're trying to find a linear function, you're just trying to estimate the parameters of a matrix, because, you know, general linear function in higher dimensions is just a matrix times a vector. So that's what learning is trying to estimate those parameters, and you're trying to learn where that decision boundary should go. So you classify the training data as well as possible, and also, and this is where it gets complicated and lots of fun starts, so you think you've got the highest probability of classifying the test data as well as possible. So that's what we call discriminative modeling. And it's a very sensible way to proceed. It's a very well-defined way to proceed, and it seems the sort of obvious way to proceed. But there is another approach, and another approach is a thing called generative modeling. And in generative modeling, the idea of generative modeling is that we're not going to focus on the class boundaries. We're going to focus on a data model for each class. So in a sense, we're going to build a machine for each class. So we're going to build a machine that generates apples and a machine that generates pears. Of course, in the world of our feature vectors, generating an apple doesn't mean generating something green and crunchy. It means generating something which has a height and a circumference similar to the heights and circumferences we've already observed for apples. So we generate a machine for each class, and basically, as well as having a machine that can generate the data belonging to that class. But when we say generate the data, what we really, really mean is we can assign a score to data for that class. So you can what your machine for generating an apple does is it can generate, you know, intuitively it's generating heights and circumferences, and it's just a probabilistic process. So it can just sit there and spit out heights and circumferences according to some probability distribution related to the training data, presumably related to the training data, inferred from the training data. Where else would you get that distribution from? But actually, what turns out to be really important is that what this generative model can do, it can generate data and it can give you a score. So it can generate data and it can give you a probability that data comes from the apple machine. And likewise, the pear machine can generate data and give you a probability that it comes from the pair machine. So in this case, classification is a little bit different. It's not basically focusing on a decision boundary. It's not focusing on some kind of discriminative function which defines the boundary between the classes. And of course, you can have more than two classes. What the generative model is doing is that each of your component models, so your apple model and your pear model, can give you a score of how likely it was to have generated that data. What's the score of it coming from the apple model versus coming from the pear model? And then you classify according to the model that you think is most likely to have generated the data, has the highest score for that particular data point. So it's a slightly different kind of conceptual setup. You may already be thinking, well, surely in the same way as we just did that little analysis for k nearest neighbor, showing that we have this algorithm to say where the nearest neighbors are, but then we could go through and for one nearest neighbor it was relatively straightforward to find the decision boundary, surely you can do that sort of thing for a generative model. And you'd be right. And we'll see that for a particular case later on. It's terrible. I keep saying we'll see this later on, and you should shoot me every time I say that. It's terrible. But we will. I'm not lying. So here's a stupid example, because I enjoyed downloading pictures of cows. No, I don't generally enjoy downloading pictures of cows, sheep, and goats. But one day a few years ago, I downloaded some pictures of cows, sheep, and goats. And this is a terribly difficult image classification problem, because you have to peer pretty closely to realize that those are goats and those are sheep, and I guess that's a sheep and so on. But this is probably what you got about 4 years ago searching Google Images for cows, sheep, and goats.
Makes an excellent Turing test.
Yeah. Some of them are quite hard, but actually, I have to say, when you, let's not go into this, when they're bigger, they're not that hard, but it does make a good Turing test. And of course, the whole point of machine learning is to beat capture tests and things, so yeah, absolutely. And this is the way people actually generate labels for data, right? And you've ever heard of a guy called Louis von Ahn, who's at Carnegie Mellon? So he does this thing of kind of generating labels for data, basically through these capture tests, and that's one way of doing it. To be honest, getting labels for data, the world has changed in the last few years because of things like that, and also things like Amazon Mechanical Turk, where it turns out people will do quite a lot of work for incredibly small amounts of money. So people will kind of listen to two sentences and say which one they think sounds better, or they'll listen to a sentence and transcribe it or something like that. And that's kind of changed things. That's another story, utterly. Anyway, this is our little example. This is supposed to be the flash of colour that wakes you up before we go back to symbols. Whoa! This is, I don't understand why this is so, but I'm using a different I'm using a different laser pointer again today, and all the keys on these things have to do is like page up, page down, and like F5 to start a presentation. And that's all the keys are. It's only got those three keys and the laser pointer. You'd think they could make it basically operating system independent. And it claims to work on Linux and Mac as well as Windows. But it's completely flaky on anything other than Windows. And it's just like ridiculous. It's only three keys. It's just insane. Anyway. I will hold my breath and hope we go to the next slide here. It doesn't work. Okay. Well, yeah. No, it's what I get for using a cheap laser pointer. Where are we? Presentation again. Okay, there we go. Yes, so the idea of generative modeling is that we have a model for each class here. So we'd have a cow's model, a sheep model, and a goat's model. And then at training time, So those models would have some parameters associated with them. And at training time, you'd go and see these examples of cows and sheep and goats, and you would estimate the parameters such that the cows model can sort of generate the cows training set it's seen with the highest possible score, and the sheep model can generate its sheep pictures with the highest possible score, and the goats model can generate the goats pictures with the highest possible score. This is called maximum likelihood training, because what you're doing is you're training the parameters of each model such that it generates its data with the maximum likelihood. You adjust the parameters so that the model is generating its data with the maximum likelihood. There are various examples that we'll look at, including things related to Gaussians and things related to a thing called naive Bayes for text classification and other stuff. So then, as I said, when you get a new previously unseen pattern, you go and see, well, what's the likelihood, what's the score of that pattern being generated by the cows model, what's the score of that pattern being generated by the sheep model, and what's the score of that pattern being generated by the goats model, and you choose the one with the highest likelihood. So it's kind of turned the problem round. Rather than trying to estimate a discriminative function and find and kind of carving up the space and then seeing what belongs to what, we actually have this conceptual process where we're looking at the probability of data being generated from the different models. Of course, the question is well, what is the generative model? Because if you wanted a real generative model for something like speech, say, well, what would you need? You'd need an accurate model of the whole kind of speech articulation system. So that, you know, includes the lungs, it includes the vocal cords, it includes your vocal tract and the tongue and the nasal cavity and the way your lips work, a model of the airflow going through there. And that's just the physical bit of generating speech. There's all this kind of stuff where you actually kind of think about what you want to say and all this. So the actual underlying generative model is incredibly complicated. So we don't do that. We typically use much, much, much simpler models. We use models that are mathematically tractable and are trainable from large amounts of data and can, in some sense, supply a likelihood score. So those are our requirements for a generative model. And so the models we look at are things like a Gaussian or normal distribution, or simple models which are essentially based on things like histograms and slightly more complex variants of those things. So those are what the generative models are. What else do I want to say? I want to say one more thing about generative models and discriminative models, and it's an interesting point of comparison between them. So, as I indicated, for sure you might have a generative model, and because it can, you get a data point, and because your generative models for different classes can supply scores to it, you could do that same thing again, where you take your space, and for each point, you go and see what the likelihood of it being generated by the different models are, and you can color that point in according to the right class, so you can have a complete map of the space. You can have a complete map of the space, so you know where each point in the space, what it's going to be classified as, given these models. So you might think, okay, so finally, what's the difference between the generative model and the discriminative model? You might get you seem to be going with a generative model in this kind of complex roundabout way of getting these boundaries. And to some extent, that's true. So the positive point and the interesting thing about generative models is that it really is a very powerful approach to go and build these statistical probabilistic models of the classes that you're interested in, of the data that you're interested in. And if you have enough data and you have a rich enough model, then it can be the best way to go, and you can do some very interesting analyses as well. The negative point of generative models is, well, there's really two things. One, although you can get this kind of set of decision boundaries from your generative models, the way they're trained is very different to the way you typically do things when you're estimating discriminative boundaries directly. So with generative models, each model only sees its own data. So the cow model becomes a model to generate cows, and it just sees cows and it learns how to generate cows really well. This is unlike what a discriminative model might do, because the discriminative model, not only is it looking to find the kind of red bits of space and blue bits of space, but when it's sort of learning that boundary, it's looking at things from both classes. So at a particular point, where a generative model is just kind of pushing up the score for a red class because it's seen an item of red class, a discriminative model at the same time will be pushing down the score for the blue class. So in a sense, you can argue it might be making slightly richer use of the data. Do I want to say anything else? It's 5 to 5, I won't. So this is the summary of what we talked about, classification and k-nearest neighbours. I didn't talk about overfitting. I talked about that last year. I thought it was far more interesting this lecture to talk about generative models. So this is if you'd been a year older, you might have had this, but you didn't. But you got generative models, which is more interesting. The next lecture will not be on Tuesday. You will have the lecture that KK previewed for you about 50 minutes ago, and you will see me again in a lecture next Friday. Some of you may see me in the tutorial on Monday, and please have a go at the tutorial questions. You even have an opportunity to write a bit of Python.
So there's two really introductory tutorials on there, which I've linked to, and also take a look at the Inf2A papers, because they do Python Inf2A, and I think they do some lectures on them. Otherwise, there's loads on the web. I mean, really. this is the same question you're just asking. So the answer is yes, I would highly recommend. Yeah, yes, basically. So in previous years, we set the coursework in Java because we knew there were some people like you who you're doing like dual engineering, right, or something. Yeah, computer science and physics. So you've done Java and not done Python. The very, very strong message we got was that it was quicker and easier and more enjoyable to learn Python and do the coursework in Python rather than doing it in Java. So there's a couple of links to very introductory things to do with Python on the Inf2B web pages. Look on the Inf2A pages as well for Python, and I'll see... there is other stuff to do with Python, but it's in a sort of different context. So, but yeah, it's certainly looking at the Inf2A stuff will help. You may or may not believe me, but it is very straightforward and is easy to learn. So yeah, I'd recommend doing that. It's yeah.